Hi everyone, you are now listening to our podcast, For a While. We are just two Filipina 30-somethings now currently based elsewhere in the world, trying to find our way and figuring out what that means for us. Our podcast is where we take a little break to regroup, share what we've learned, and find new ways to move forward. I'm Kirsty.
And I'm Andrea, and if you hear something that resonates, we'd love for you to let us know. Today, we wanted to talk about going abroad because in the Philippines, it's such a big part of our culture where we want to try our luck outside. I mean, for whatever reason, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I agree with you that there's so many Filipinos all over the world who have migrated for various reasons, I'm sure. But obviously, employment is a big part of that. And anyway, even if you moved across the world for any other reason, maybe it's family, maybe it's school, eventually you get to the point where you're looking at employment, right? And looking at jobs. But obviously, both of us don't live in the Philippines at the moment. We live abroad. You're in Singapore. I am in the UK. And you've previously lived in Hong Kong and in Des Moines.
Yeah, that's right, in the US. Yeah. And to be honest, I'm not sure if Singapore is the final pit stop on Ooh. Our life journey.
Yeah, you/we are very young.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there is other cities and countries and places that we're likely going to move to in the future.
That's true.
Yeah. So I'm especially curious about your experience, actually, especially with moving around so much to just different parts of the world, what that's been like for you. I guess say how different as well it's been to, say, moving from Cebu to Manila, because you've lived there as well for college, for university, as well as for work.
Right. To be honest, moving from Cebu to Manila for college, I feel like it's such a faraway concept for me, also because I've changed so much as a person from moving from Cebu to Manila and then moving back to Cebu a little bit to start working there and then moving back to Manila again. So I feel like it was definitely a stressful experience because I was doing it by myself. I didn't have as much support as I did now where, you know, I'm with somebody, I live with somebody, and moving around, it's not a solo experience. And moving is one of the most, if not the most, I feel like I read somewhere that it's the second most stressful thing to experience. And I've moved around a lot, not just from place to place, but, you know, moving homes within the same city and so on. So I feel like it's definitely easier. What I think, in case the readers might be interested in, is really more of the logistics of, you know, how was I able to move around from Des Moines to Hong Kong and then Singapore, and really more of the visa implications, I think. Because for Filipinos, it's a bit more of a challenge to move from country to country. Mm-hmm. Getting approvals to be able to live somewhere and so on. And even now in Singapore, you know, I have friends who are looking to move elsewhere, like I have somebody who just moved to Canada, and I have, even in the midst of lockdown, people are working on moving to Australia. So I feel like that's something that we can discuss more in case there are, did I say readers, in case there are listeners who might be interested in that process.
Yeah, that sounds great. Especially, I think if this is good timing, you know, this is the beginning of the year. And I think a lot of people at the beginning of the year put down their goals. And I know that there are individuals out there who are kind of writing down their goals and putting down, you know, apply to a new job or mm-hmm. countries they want to visit and places they want to move to, which granted is probably difficult this year, extra difficult because of so many travel mm-hmm. restrictions and just, you mm-hmm. know, how it's all going with the pandemic. But obviously these are things that are relevant no matter the year. There probably will just be extra restrictions around, you know, obviously ensuring that you're healthy and you're not passing. We're not sort of contributing towards the growth of the pandemic. But mm-hmm. where do you want to start? Do you want to start with the US?
Maybe let's start with you. I feel like I feel like your journey has been quite straightforward, the whole process from finding a school, and maybe you can speak to your siblings' experiences as well.
Okay, yeah. So obviously me moving to the UK, if you don't know, the listeners don't know, I moved because I went to university. So obviously me moving to the UK was for educational purposes. I guess the most stressful, the hardest part of it really was applying to a university. And in the UK, if you don't know, there is a whole system in place on how you apply to universities, typically for an undergraduate degree. So you're doing a bachelor's. Everyone applies through the UCAS system, or is it called a system? But the UCAS program. Let me double check what it stands for.
And did you find that with your IB or international baccalaureate, it was easier for you to get your foot in the door? Do you think it would be more difficult for somebody with just a regular high school diploma in the Philippines to apply for university?
So if you're coming to the UK and you have a high school diploma from the Philippines, you won't be able to directly go on to an undergraduate degree. You would likely have to take a foundation degree just because of how they kind of, I guess, convert the like the certificate or the levels of schooling, you know, that kind of thing. So you'll likely take a foundation course, which is about a year. If you have the international baccalaureate and you apply to schools in the US or schools actually in Manila or schools in the Philippines, which I did, I applied to Ateneo. And then I applied to a few schools in the US. And one of the schools that I applied to basically offered me like a scholarship and like credits towards the subjects I'd taken as part of my IB diploma. So I guess for many, in theory, if you've got the IB diploma, then you would have less subjects to take in the first year or two of your
college degree
in the US. Wow. Yeah. So a lot of it is minor.
It's actually like some sort of shortcut.
Yeah. And then obviously less credits, right? It translates to a saving as well.
Yeah.
As far as I know, they discount you for that, right? So yeah, there's that. And I know that there's universities in the Philippines as well who will credit your IB diploma and will take out minors, I think. Some minors, but I think it depends. I think there are definitely places around the world, even in the UK, where they don't know about the IB diploma all that much. Most people don't. It's just another thing, right? It's just another kind of diploma, I guess, another certificate. It's another way of getting that qualification. But yeah, so when you apply to the UK, you apply through UCAS, which is, I've just looked up, it stands for the Universities and Colleges Admission Service. Typically, it's like all online. Let me double click on this just to make sure that it's still the same. You apply, and then there is typically a maximum amount of universities you can apply to. You can't just apply to like 20.
Mm-hmm. That's good to know, especially since, for example, if you have a kid, right, and I'm based in Singapore right now, there are a lot of things to consider when you think about planning for a child. So, for example, where to send them to school. And international school, I guess, is preferred, especially since you mentioned, you know, taking an IB, it's like a shortcut and it's easier for you to be able to apply to college abroad. And even in Singapore, from what I've heard from my friends who are academics in Singapore, who are doing their PhDs in NUS right now, or who have done their master's in NUS, there, even if you want to work in Singapore afterwards, there's still a preference for people who have studied abroad, even if Singapore has actually one of the best colleges in the world. So there's still that preference for people who have studied abroad. And I guess it's also because, you know, a different experience. It's also something that counts. So in the end, like, if you're already considering children, or if you're already thinking about it, you know, it might be more cost efficient to have your kids study in international school in the Philippines and then have them shoot for studying abroad as compared to bringing them up in Singapore and then paying the extra cost for an international school, which is probably twice or three times the cost of studying in an international school in the Philippines and even Hong Kong.
Yeah, yeah. I think especially nowadays, I always feel like, you know how loads of people always say like, oh, all these like, not so much millennials, I guess. What's the next one? Gen Zs, right?
Yeah.
Is Gen Zs the one below us where all these people are like, oh, Gen Zs, they're so entitled. They're so annoying. They're so dumb, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, that's not true. Like, maybe, yes, you as an older person is like annoyed by these young people, but so many people are anyway, no matter what, right? But I feel like people, the kids now who are in high school, who are in elementary school, and they're making their way up, right, to university, I feel like they have more to deal with than we did when we were their age.
I definitely agree that like they have pressure so much harder.
They have to work so much harder. The expectation, I think, is so much higher than it was for us. And it's like, you need to be so good at so many. I feel like the threshold to be successful or like
remarkable.
Yeah, it's really, really high. You can't just be okay and good enough. You kind of have to be the super duper overachiever. And it's kind of not surprising that so many people are burning out at such a young age when the pressures are so high. And like, I have kind of strong feelings around things like standardized testing and making people, well, I don't know. I have feelings about university in general, which some people are surprised about, considering, you know, I've done the bachelor's, I've done the master's, I'm doing a PhD, and people think that I'm someone who's like super, what's the right word? I'm trying to think. Someone who's like super duper like, yeah, universities are great, but I kind of am someone who kind of feels like, one, why do you expect a 16, 17, 18 year old to be able to figure out what they want to do for the rest of their life and pick out the right degree to be able to do that job forever and all that stuff? I think it's kind of stupid.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. And I also feel like there's so much tests and exams and testing that just does not really matter in the grand scheme of things. And sometimes I wish that we could just go back to, like, I don't know, the olden days when people just went to university and studied stuff just because they wanted to. The people who went to university were people who just wanted to learn, rather than making university this money-making machine that kind of just churns out people with qualifications versus people who are like learners. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I don't know. I think it's hard to just change everything because it's gotten to here for a reason. But I feel like 2020 and how the experiences of students have changed so much this year, beginning with online learning and probably figuring out how unnecessary some university degrees are for what you want to do with your life. I think things might change in the future. I feel like things like, you know, like SATs and standardized tests, you know, like IQ type tests, I don't think they mean all that much. I know it's people's way of just comparing one student with another. It's the best thing they can think of. But I feel like it's a very industrial revolution type way of treating students. Like, we're in 2020. This isn't how we should be running schools.
I like the way that you put it, industrial revolution. And I do recognize that there is so much inertia involved with regard to changing a system that's been working. Well, working is like an overstatement. It's been in place for how many decades already. And it's just so hard to pivot from that. And it still has that stigma wherein if you go to a school that's not a traditional university and if you go to a newer school, you know, there is there is a bit of a reputation that comes with that school.
Yeah, agree.
Some of the things that came to mind when you were talking about that, especially now in the time of COVID, is that I recently read a headline where students these days, children these days, are facing so much more mental health issues now that they've had to shift to studying at home. Mm-hmm. I've also noticed that a lot of students, for example, in Manila, have actually decided to postpone their schooling because of COVID, just because they feel that studying from home might not be conducive for them, might not be effective for them. So it's better to just wait it out, especially since times are so stressful these days. I mean, how can anybody even, you know, try to work from home and study from home as if, you know, it's normal? It just feels so bizarre that we have to make a shift like this, such a big shift. Something that I also remembered is that a friend, for example, Q's classmate from MBA, they noted how MBA applications have gone way down because of COVID. And so a lot of them have actually extended their application deadlines, and some of them are even foregoing GMAT test results altogether just to get their numbers up. But I really wonder, if does anybody even think that taking an MBA in this time is useful? Like, is it still a good career choice considering COVID? Like, I'm wondering what the implications are. And I have some learnings as well, you know, looking for a job and realizing, oh, maybe I should have done this instead with my career. Maybe I wouldn't have had such a hard time trying to find work abroad, which is also why I wanted to do this episode. I feel like I just wanted to share my potential learnings or what I would have done differently if I had the chance.
Okay, yeah, let's move on to that. Just to wrap my bit up, basically, like I said, went to university, did all that, and I've kind of stayed since. I think the main difference here will be that I do have a British passport. I am a British citizen. So, and I was a British citizen before I moved to the UK for my university. I recognize that I didn't have that extra hurdle and process to take in terms of, you know, getting a student visa and stuff. And obviously that's taken away the, I guess, almost like extra stress you would have when you're finding a job afterwards. Because if I didn't find a job, you know, I can stay here fine, right? I don't have to kind of look for an employer who is willing to give me a work visa, things like that, which it's added. It's like added work. It's added stuff that you need to figure out. So I don't have that, which I am obviously very grateful for. But my siblings have gone abroad as well. My sister went to the US, and that was fairly straightforward. She also applied to a school and got accepted, and obviously she got a US visa for that. And then on the US visa, after you're a student, I think you can convert your visa, and then you can stay in the US for like a year to work. Which she did, and she worked for that year. And then my other sister went to Australia for university. And then also for that, she, you know, applied through IDP.
What does IDP stand for?
IDP? It doesn't actually say what it stands for. What does it stand for? Well, it just says originally known as IDP Education Australia. IDP was established in the Philippines in 1985 as support.
So it's a firm. So are they a private firm, or are they?
Yeah, so they kind of just, they run like IELTS and all that stuff, because obviously for, say, Australia, you need to take the IELTS, right? So they run that. They're kind of like your liaison, I guess, officer when you're applying for stuff to Australia specifically. So you go to IDP, and then you speak to them about, I guess, what you're looking for, the universities that you're maybe interested in, and then you can sort of show them your qualifications, your certificates, your diplomas, all that stuff, and they just help you figure out how to do everything, which is useful.
So applying to a school in Australia is not that straightforward. You have to have help from a firm like IDP.
No, you can do it yourself.
Oh.
Yeah, you can do it yourself. but I guess this was useful doing it this way. She did it through that. She got a visa and obviously went and studied there. And I think, as far as I know, in Australia as well, after you finish university, I think there is one of those things where you can convert your visa then to a work visa for a limited period of time. My sister didn't do that. She went back to the Philippines. I'm just looking on here, and IDP also helps with study in Canada, in the UK, in New Zealand, and Ireland as well. So if people are interested, I guess look at IDP. That might be a useful first step at seeing how you can sort of, I guess, package your qualifications together, or package yourself together, right, for your, like, your application, because they obviously are familiar with the qualifications and diplomas that people have in the Philippines, and how, like, what that means then for universities abroad, like how you convert that and all that stuff. So if people are interested in studying abroad, that might be a good first place to look. But yeah, apart from that, obviously, that's a very kind of short, I guess, summary of how I've done it and how I've gotten here and how my siblings have as well. But obviously, my experience is different to a lot of people, just because I didn't have that extra hurdle of visas.
And I imagine it would be cheaper for you as well with regard to university fees.
So it was not. For my undergraduate, it was not. Well, the main reason was because we weren't living here for like the 3 years prior to starting university.
Oh, so that's a requirement.
Yeah.
For you to avail of the lower fees.
Yes. If you have a parent who does live here, then that's probably okay. Yeah. So my undergraduate, I had to pay international fees. When I did my master's, something I would suggest is you speak to, like, if you want to do a master's, speak to the people running the course, because I'd spoken to the person running the course while I was doing my undergraduate, said I was interested, all these things. He said that I did a course that was well funded by industry, so that they had the money to offer kind of scholarships to people. So everyone who did that course who was a home student, which at that point they classed me as a home student for my master's degree, everyone who was a home student didn't have to pay tuition fee. The university used the funding that they have from industry to pay for everyone's tuition fees. So I didn't have to pay tuition fee for that, which is good. And then obviously I'm doing a PhD now, and I don't pay for my tuition fee as well, because I'm funded. I'm fully funded. So I don't pay for my tuition fee, and I receive a stipend for the work I'm doing. So yes, that's something to look at as well if you're doing postgraduate studies, because there are places where you can look at getting your studies funded.
Would you say it was easier for you to get that funding for your PhD?
How do you mean?
Was it easy to apply for funding?
Yeah, so actually this will depend subject to subject, but typically in the sciences, which obviously I'm doing a science degree, like a science PhD, science related one. The sciences, unfortunately, actually, for a lot of other fields, the sciences are so much more well funded than, say, the arts, because I don't know, I guess it's just like industry, right? So many companies put money into this. There's so much money that gets put into research. So when I applied to my PhD, my project was already funded. So me applying to the PhD, the project, I already knew it was funded. So that was fine. So that happens in almost all of the PhD projects, in like physics and engineering, probably in chemistry, biology, all that stuff. Usually the project is already funded. So, and then they're looking for someone to take the project on, which is good, because you don't have to look for the funding yourself. It's already there. So that's a good thing. There is a, I guess, a kind of like a caveat to that, where if you're in the UK, it is kind of easier to receive funding if you are a home student or an EU student or an EU person, I guess, mainly because of like the funding rules, where the research council, that part funds it has like a rule around who they can fund. So that there's that. Although with Brexit, that's changed now, I think. I think in the next maybe 1 or 2 years left before they won't be funding EU students anymore, I think. I'm not entirely sure. I think there are some kind of new rules around that. But there are individuals that I know of who are from abroad. Say if you're from, you know, China or someone from India. And then I knew someone who was from Malaysia as well. And so many of them are actually funded by their own governments, which is nice, right? So they get sent abroad. So places like the UK to do an undergrad or a master's or a PhD. They do their studies. Wow. They're funded by their governments. And then they go back to their own countries and they work there, right? They work for the government for a bit. They might have like a 5-year contract, a 3-year contract, whatever. But they're basically being sent in order to come back to the country and share what they've learned. So that's nice as well for them. Quite a long summary for a podcast, but it's just a short overview of my experience, I guess. But I think I'm especially curious to know what you've done, Anne, with moving around, because obviously this is one country. So yeah.
What I did is I married someone who went to school in the U.S. basically. So my husband's an MBA student and we were long distance for a while. But when you mentioned that some governments send some of their citizens abroad to study, I encountered that with my husband's classmates. But instead of governments, it's companies in Japan send their employees to get an MBA in the U.S. and then come back. So it's interesting that option is available. Depends on where you are, I guess. And similar to what happened with your sister, is that's how he initially got a job. Basically, you graduate from there. That allows you to stay for a year and look for a job and work there. And then if your company sponsors you for a more permanent working visa with a longer duration, you can apply for the lottery, so they'll sponsor you for a lottery, and then if you get chosen during the lottery, you can stay there. So that typically happens in April. For regular graduate students, you get like 1 year to find a job until you get an opportunity to apply for the visa lottery, and if you get chosen, you get a longer period to work and stay. For STEM students, and I believe for PhDs as well, that length of time to stay gets extended to 3 years. So you have 3 years to look for a job and or apply for the lottery. And because the lottery happens every year, that gives you 3 chances. One chance to apply for a lottery every year for 3 years. The thing about me as a spouse in the States, as a dependent spouse, is that I actually wasn't allowed to find work. I was not free to look for a job. If ever I wanted to find a job, like, there would have had to be a company that was willing to sponsor me as well for an H-1B visa. So that's a big limitation about working in the U.S., having a spouse or having a family with you. The other thing that I would like to mention that not a lot of people realize is that if you're a U.S. citizen and if you work abroad, you still have to pay federal taxes even if you're working abroad. It's just that coming from the Philippines, where there's the American dream, where living in the U.S. is so aspirational, the issue of going abroad and then paying taxes, and then also healthcare is such a big problem in the U.S. That might be like a trade-off some people would want to consider, but all in all, working in the U.S., I believe, is still good working experience, especially if you plan to come back to the Philippines or somewhere closer in Asia. It's still a good experience and it's still something notable and remarkable to put in your resume afterwards. So we just stayed there for a year. We actually did not get a visa when we did the lottery. We did not get chosen for an extended working visa. So what happened was that we ended up moving to Hong Kong first, and then in Hong Kong, compared to the U.S., where there was so much red tape involved with, you know, moving there and living there. With regard to applying for work in Hong Kong. Like, my husband was able to get a transfer from his company in order to work in Hong Kong. Getting a visa there to work in Hong Kong was so straightforward. It was so quick. And this was also just right when the civil conflict started in Hong Kong, where so many people were protesting. So I'm wondering if that might have had a factor with regard to getting a working visa quickly and moving there quickly. It was very straightforward. There were no questions asked compared to our experience in the US. So we were able to move there. And then when we moved there, I found out automatically as a dependent, I could find work. And I was able to do that right away with marketing. But what I found is that, number one, comparing job markets, for example, Hong Kong and Singapore, Hong Kong actually has less regional offices than Singapore. A lot of regional headquarters are located in Singapore. So that might be like a factor if you're deciding whether to work in Hong Kong or Singapore. I feel like there are more job opportunities in Singapore simply because there are more regional headquarters there. Mm-hmm. Hong Kong is also treated as like a secondary market and as an extension of the Chinese market. Mm. So it's because the population is so small. And this is coming from my line of work, which is in marketing. Hong Kong is so small for digital marketing and marketing in general, the experience might not be something that's worthwhile if it's treated as a stepping stone. If you want to work in Hong Kong just for the sake of working in Hong Kong, that's fine. But as a career move, it might be more of a challenge to look for work that gives you a bigger scope in terms of handling markets. Mm-hmm. And because Hong Kong is so small, the marketing budgets are actually smaller, especially digitally. So with regard to like in digital marketing, it's not actually as sophisticated as what you would find in the Philippines.
Right.
Because people are more digitally savvy as compared to Hong Kong, where they're not as big social media users as Filipinos are. And because of that, it's easier to cast a wider net instead of being more sophisticated with your targeting for digital marketing. If you want to gain a regional exposure, those job opportunities are more difficult to come by. Though definitely now because of COVID and because of the protests in Hong Kong, more and more they're jumping on the digital bandwagon. But because majority of Hong Kongers, they speak more Cantonese, I would say Singapore is more of an international market than Hong Kong. I feel like it's more difficult to find a job in Hong Kong.
Yeah, I guess especially like just the language alone, right?
In
Singapore, it's very like, of course it's in English.
Yes. In Singapore, I do find jobs where they require you to speak Mandarin. I feel like that's also a deterrent because, of course, there's more of a preference towards hiring locals. They're definitely more protective of ensuring that Singaporeans get the jobs.
Yeah.
So with regard to moving to Singapore, for example, in Hong Kong, I could work no problem. I didn't have to ask permission to work. It was easy. It was de facto, yes, I could find a job, no problem. One thing also that's notable about working in Hong Kong is that the taxes are very low. And my husband got a pretty significant tax break for having a dependent spouse. In Singapore, that's not so much the case. Taxes in the US are very high. We ended up paying 30 to 40% in state and federal taxes. But housing there, where we lived in Des Moines, it was a lot cheaper. So those are the trade-offs that we had to consider moving. And in Singapore, it's a lot more difficult, especially now, for foreigners to enter the workforce because, for example, if a company wants to look for a new hire, before they can start considering foreigners, they have to go post their job openings exclusively to Singaporeans for a minimum of 6 months. If they don't find the right person, then that's when they can start advertising to foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, it doesn't make you immune from the government questioning you whether this hire is a legitimate hire, whether a Singaporean should have been hired for the job instead. So it's actually quite, it's very strict. And recently, because of COVID, the minimum salary requirement for a foreigner to be able to take on work in Singapore has increased.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
For example, your salary needs to be a certain minimum as a foreigner for you to be working in Singapore.
What's the minimum?
So I think before it was $4,000 a month, but mm-hmm. now it's been increased to $4,500 a month.
Mm-hmm.
So as a foreigner, you need to make a minimum of $4,500 a month in order to be able to work in Singapore.
It's kind of similar to here where there was a kind of, they were putting in a minimum income for foreigners mm-hmm. in order for them to be able to stay and continue on with their work visas. I really think this is sort of a way to appease locals, really.
Yeah.
So that they don't feel like, oh, these foreigners are coming over and just claiming benefits. That's basically what I personally believe this is all about. But something that I did read a few months ago now, I think, but it was how they've reduced that threshold, I think, for people in the medical field, people in the NHS, mm-hmm. because there are obviously a huge number of people, healthcare workers here in the UK are from abroad, including the Philippines, obviously. I think the Philippines is like the second or the third nationality, third most abundant, that like there's the most people from that nationality in the NHS, and so like mm-hmm. it's like they reduce that threshold for people in healthcare workers because they need the people. Like the huge issue now all over the NHS, and I think in so many parts of the world, is that they're running low on healthcare workers to do mm-hmm. all the work. So I think that's something that might change, I think, depending on how this year goes. But I think it was really interesting to hear about the differences between Singapore and Hong Kong that you mentioned, especially like in the mm-hmm. digital space, because that's not something that I necessarily thought about. I didn't know about how that could be different, because you think of Hong Kong as one of the main hubs, right, for
yeah
business in Asia.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
For instance, when you watch the news, so much of the news in Asia, whether it's like CNN or BBC, like a lot of it is based in Hong Kong, and then you've got also like the stock exchange.
Yeah.
And you kind of think that translates then into the digital space and business and marketing, like in your field. But mm-hmm. you raise a great point around even just like language, right? It's like different. I guess also when you mentioned about it being kind of a, what word did you use? I think you said something like it was an extension of China.
Yeah, secondary market.
Yes. I'm just thinking as well about how do you think like kind of restrictions about the digital space and social media in China, kind of some of it extends into Hong Kong, and how it's just maybe harder to just navigate that area compared to other countries where, you know, when you think about things like censorship, it's not an issue in the same way.
Well, it's not an issue in the same way yet. From my experience, it's not that China has all of these censorship rules with regard to Hong Kong right now. Well, it's more of social media, or at least the particular social media that we use, Twitter, Facebook, it's just not as popular culturally in Hong Kong as they are elsewhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just not what they use. People in Hong Kong, I guess, are just not as digital as they were before. Maybe times have changed in 2020, now that a lot of us have had to stay home and such. But people are just not as digital as they are now. Maybe it's changed in 2020. Why should we invest in e-commerce, for example? Hong Kongers are just going to go out. They'd rather go out because their apartments are so tiny. What else is there to do in Hong Kong except shop?
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. So why should I bother with an e-commerce platform? Things like that. It's more of just regular behavior as compared to, you know, whether China has been a factor. Maybe it is a factor now.
Yeah.
Since I've left. But I think it's more of culturally, it's just not in their behaviors.
So what did you have to do in Singapore around visas, for example? Can you walk us through kind of like the logistics of that, apart from the kind of income threshold?
There's a logistics company that helps walk you through the visa process. So once that's done, we basically had to wait in Hong Kong for Singapore's approval before we could make any moves in regard to moving to Singapore. By the way, Singapore is very, again, protective. So it's like somebody could actually raise a dispute against a particular person if they think that person was hired unfairly, or if they think that someone else should have been hired that was a local. There's a whistleblower culture here. So you really have to do things by the book. As a dependent, it's easier for me to find a job because I don't have to follow the quotas of Singapore in order to find work. There's a quota for foreigners. A company can only hire a certain number of foreigners at any given period.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. That's also part of what makes it challenging. As a person on an employment pass, like my husband cannot work for any other company part-time. They are really bound to their company. But as a dependent, I don't have that restriction against me. I'm basically counted as Singaporean. But even then, if I start a new job, I have to get a letter of consent from the Ministry of Manpower. And the company that I'm working for is going to facilitate that process. They're going to apply for the letter of consent on my behalf that I can work there. But I guess it's more of a formality. It's not really something that, in my experience, hasn't really gone through any questioning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every time I switch jobs, like I have to get another letter of consent. And then it's valid for a period of 2 years as the employment pass is. And my dependent pass or my letter of consent is only valid for 2 years unless something happens to my husband's employment pass. So it's also contingent on his own employment pass as a dependent.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Coming from my friends who have also studied here and also in the field of marketing. So what I've learned is, yeah, number one, it's still more valuable to have studied abroad than to have taken master's here. Like, there's still a preference for people who've studied abroad. Number two, context-wise, yes, there are more jobs that are regional, but it's really important. So, for example, if you're just starting out and if your goal is really to work abroad, it's important to work for multinationals ahead of time, because I feel like I had such a challenge getting my resume looked at coming from a company in the Philippines that nobody has heard of.
Yeah, but the most recent company that you worked at, everyone's heard of that one.
Nope.
Really, it has to be like actual Coca-Cola, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Right. Interesting.
When you look at the Philippines from that lens where you're looking for a job abroad, it doesn't matter if you worked at a top company in the Philippines. Nobody's going to recognize it when someone's hiring you.
Yeah.
So it's really important to get that name brand recognition to get your foot in the door.
Yeah.
So yeah, if to work at a place like Nestle or Unilever or HSBC, that will increase your chances of getting your resume looked at. Study abroad. I mean, of course, there are industries where talent from the Philippines is preferable. But even like I have a friend here, so she's a doctor in the Philippines. She can't find work as a doctor here in Singapore. You basically have to start over. That's why she has better chances of finding work as a doctor in Australia. And that's why she's trying to make the transition to Australia now.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend who's in public relations. That's her line of work. And then she studied here. But then now she's having a difficult time looking for work because public relations is so highly contextualized according to, you know, local culture. That's not something that you can easily pick up.
Yeah.
Right?
That is true.
Even with a lot of experience, it doesn't count in the Singaporean context. So that's also something to consider. Like, I didn't think of that, you know, coming here. So I feel like if someone's target is really to work abroad, even from the beginning, you have to already make those plans. Because in hindsight, I feel like, yeah, it would have been easier maybe for me to find work if I was already working like at a multinational.
That's a really good point that you've mentioned, actually. Because you know how I mean, even on this podcast in the past, I have kind of, I may have said things about my previous work experience and where I used to work, not so much because of the company, but just because of how I felt, I guess.
Yeah.
But that is something that I am grateful for, because the company that I did work at was like an international company, right? They've got offices all over the world, although it's not a name that's like Nestle or Pepsi or, you know what I mean? It's not a name like that. It's definitely, I guess, more niche in the engineering field. But it's kind of something that I've realized that is just one of those things that you can add to your CV as experience, right? And for instance, for me, working in kind of science and engineering, and specifically in like the nuclear industry, even like here in the UK, when they say, if I mention this is where I used to work, they know what that means immediately.
Yeah.
And they know that when I say this is the type of work I was doing there, they know what that means, and they know that you understand. So I worked a lot in like safety case writing. So they know that when I say I worked in fuel route in safety case writing at this company, and other people in the field know that, right, okay, yeah, if you've done that, you know what we're on about. You have an understanding of this. And obviously, it might be a little bit different to say marketing in general, right? Because obviously, when it comes to like safety, the safety requirements, engineering, all that stuff, it's very prescriptive and very kind of, I don't know, there's like rules, right? There's like rules on what you need to, like, for instance, safety. There's like safety rules that you need to abide by. There's like guidelines and all that stuff. So they know that if you've done this work before, you have an understanding. I'm grateful for that, for sure, regardless of, you know, burning out and all that stuff, which is a whole other story. But yeah, I completely appreciate what you're saying as far as that, and having that experience in like the corporate, kind of a large corporate multinational like that. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of For a While. Catch you in the next one. Bye.